This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Welcome to Time Sensitive, a film podcast exploring the best and worst under-the-radar movies released in the past 18 months. I'm Sam, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Ian.
Shalom, Sam.
Why?
Shalom.
I know you're trying to do it different each time.
It's my Olivia Colman impression. Shalom, Sam. Hello and welcome to the show. This week we talk nostalgia, romance, racism, mental illness, and the magic of movies, all conveniently and clumsily encased in a maudlin prestige drama. It's our first foray into gerontophilia since Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude. Actually, that's kind of rude because she's not that old. She looks older than she is. That's rude. It's an old person and a young person getting it on. It's Empire of Light, directed by Sam Mendes.
It's a melting pot. It's a little bit of everything. If you're new to Time Sensitive, welcome, especially if you made it through that intro. And if you're a returning listener, welcome back. You know what you're getting into.
Our show is unique. Sam and I like to review movies not immediately upon their release like most podcasts do, but one last time, about a year or so later, before they disappear into the history books.
And we focus on those movies that might have fallen through the cracks, not the major blockbusters or the billion-dollar grocers, but the quality cinema swimming just beneath the surface.
We want to talk about every element of a movie, from acting and screenwriting to technical choices, music, release structure, and so much more. We really dive into why these movies might be under the radar in the first place, and why they might deserve more love. Or at the very least, another watch. And we kick off this week, Sam, back to the 2022 film cycle here in season 5.
Back to movie reviews.
We just had a nice big break for the Oscars, including this movie, which was nominated.
It was.
Which we'll talk more about in a little bit. But tell us, you selected this movie.
I did.
Why? Because you actually had really nice things to say about it, and I was like, sure, okay, Sam likes it.
I trust him
about 50% of the time.
That's fair. Yeah. And I don't know if you're going to ever trust me again after this one. I watched this one right before the Oscars, trying to catch it because I knew it was nominated for cinematography, which is the only Oscar it was nominated for. And I watched it in bits and pieces on my laptop on HBO Max. And I didn't have a bad time with it. I had a pretty decent time with it. It was nothing really to write home about, but I think it could lend itself to an interesting conversation. And I don't think we've ever really done an Oscar bait movie like this before.
We've talked about Oscar bait movies as a genre
exactly,
before.
But I don't think we've done one so specifically an Oscar bait movie.
No.
And this is definitely one of those.
This is it. We're going to have fun. It's going to be an interesting conversation. So you are exactly right. All of our conversations are. Well,
sometimes.
Most of the time.
But before we get started, I want to give you a little alert. The great thing about Time Sensitive is that you don't need to have seen Empire of Light to listen to our discussion. Sure, it helps, but it's not required. We get it. Your time is sensitive and everyone is busy. So we do the hard part and watch the movie for you. So sit back and let us tell you if it's worth your time, seeing that we don't shy away from anything. This is your spoiler alert.
However, if you don't want us to spoil the movie for you, and you have not already seen Empire of Light, pause this episode right now and head over to HBO Max, where the movie is streaming free for subscribers.
Empire of Light has a runtime of 1 hour and 54 minutes. The film is rated R for sexual content, language, and brief violence.
Finally, a movie that has nudity that does not call it out.
Does it have actual nudity?
We see a little buttocks.
Oh, you see some butt.
Yes, that's it.
I know what qualifies for Ian is like you need to see the peen.
Full peen. Don't call it nudity unless we see full peen. So in reality, this movie fits my standard because it wouldn't mention
it. They didn't claim it. Yeah.
Didn't claim it. Well, Sam Mendes is now the most recent high-profile director that we are covering here on season 5 of Time Sensitive. We've been doing a little bit bigger names than we have before.
We have, because kind of they've flopped a lot.
Some career retrospectives, I think, is a better way to say that.
Sure.
Mendes first hit the scene by actually hitting the stage. He directed a number of plays both at Cambridge University, his alma mater, and the Donmar Warehouse, which is a staple of London's West End. Mm-hmm. So basically, he's the poshiest of the posh.
This did kind of feel like a play, so that kind of makes sense.
He's just fully British. I think that's clear. He transitioned to film, though, in 1999 with the Best Picture-winning American Beauty, which won him an Academy Award for Best Director for his debut film.
I completely forgot that he directed that.
Yeah, we talked about American Beauty very briefly when we did Uncle Frank, because it was written by Alan Ball, who also wrote American Beauty. But yes, Sam Mendes directed his first movie ever that he directed.
That's incredible.
Was American Beauty, which is very different than the style that he cultivated in West End. Basically, his theater company was responsible for taking more dark versions of classic plays and musicals.
Oh, I was going to say, I was like, you don't think American Beauty is dark?
No, it is, but it's not adapting something.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So it was different. He didn't write that one, by the way. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk more about his writing style, but as a director, he started in 1989, and right off the bat, wins an Oscar. Empire of Light, though, is actually his 9th feature film now as a director, following Road to Perdition, Jarhead, Revolutionary Road, Away We Go, James Bond installments Skyfall and Spectre, and most recently the Oscar-winning World War I film 1917, which was inspired by stories of Mendes' own grandfather. Empire of Light, according to him, is considered a continuation of that story, 1917, this time focusing more directly on the director's own mother and his childhood.
Oh, I was like, how is that a continuation of 1917?
It's just the family story continues.
Sure, okay. Yeah. That makes more sense.
Yes, and again, 1917 is not specifically about his grandfather, just based on those stories. Where 1917 was his first screenwriting effort in his career, he had never written before that, at least not for film, for which he earned an Academy Award nomination for original screenplay time, alongside Christy Wilson Cairns, who co-wrote it with him. Empire is actually his first solo writing project.
Yeah, and he decided, hey, this screenwriting process, I'm actually going to add words to the movie and see how that pans out.
And it didn't pan out so well. But he basically wrote the movie while in quarantine. He talks about giving a chance to be more reflective, and just wanted time to make a personal story.
I haven't heard Sam Mendes speak before, so I don't know if that accent.
It doesn't sound anything like him. He can actually talk like this. I actually don't know. I've never heard him speak either. I just kind of looked at him. But filming for Empire of Light began in early 2022 on the southern coast of England in the countryside of Kent. Which we're in Kent Woods, so I guess there's a close connection.
Hey.
Hello!
Don't dox me, please.
It was billed as, quote, a love story set in and around a beautiful old cinema on the south coast of England in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Basically what we got. It received a limited theatrical release by Searchlight Pictures on December 9th of 2022 after premiering at the Telluride Film Festival a few months earlier. And as Sammy already mentioned, it earned a single Oscar nomination for Best Cinematography at the 95th Academy Awards. Empire of Light joins a slate of other films in recent years where famous directors have sculpted fictionalized versions of their childhoods. Of course, Alfonso Cuarón did this with Roma, Paolo Sorrentino did it with The Hand of God, Kenneth Branagh for Belfast, and time-sensitive subject Apollo 10 and a Half, Richard Linklater, anyone?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And even this year's Best Picture nominated The Fablemans, directed by Steven Spielberg. So, vanity projects, line them up.
Yeah,
we got them.
So many of them.
Yes. But Sam, for those who are not familiar with Empire of Light and think that we are venturing into a new Star Wars adaptation, please tell them what this movie is about.
Yes. The plot summary here is Hillary is a cinema manager struggling with her mental health while withstanding the sexual predation of her boss. Steven is a young black man, a new employee under Hillary's supervision, longing to escape the small town where he faces daily adversity. Together, they find romance and a sense of belonging while experiencing the healing power of music, cinema, and community.
And Sam, that's how British people write their movie descriptions.
Yes.
What is this basically about?
Oh, gosh. This movie is basically about a predatory boss in two circumstances. So we have... Colin Firth is a bit predatory to Hillary. Hillary, if you really think about it, is also taking advantage of a young employee. It's not shown that way.
This is a Law and Order SV episode in a movie cinema.
Yeah, it's a movie filled with so many different things that it's hard, like, because there's no real story with it, honestly. Like, when we leave the story, like, somebody left town. That was about it. It was like, we're dealing with racism and mental illness, and then we just leave.
And we don't talk about either of them much beyond calling them out.
Yeah, we mention they exist.
Yes.
We do not describe much further than that. We do not dig deep.
Right. That's the good summary. A Me Too movement where we call out things and then don't talk about them beyond that.
But damn, is it pretty.
It's very pretty. I actually might have a suggestion to make this more interesting, and we'll get to that later.
Ooh,
in the episode. But let's talk about our first impressions, because you saw this first. Again, you recommended this one for us to watch. So please tell us about your first movie-going experience and your initial thoughts as the credits began to roll.
Yeah, I... was pleasantly surprised. I don't seeing a movie like this that only got one nomination. I was a little surprised by that. I can understand it after a second viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched it in pieces at first, and then I watched it again last night in its entirety. And you can kind of feel, if you're not watching in bits and pieces, that it drags a bit. It feels longer than maybe it is. It's under 2 hours, so mm-hmm. it's not too bad on that front. But overall, I was like, good movie watching experience. Nothing didn't make me feel too much, even though it's trying to make you feel a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't. I wasn't like frustrated while watching it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't feel anything. I was kind of
dead inside.
It wasn't a negative experience.
Sure.
I thought it flowed fine. I didn't really feel it was dull, other than it was just boring. Like the dull
and boring, I think, are synonyms.
I'm using them separately here.
Okay.
Dull in the fact that nothing happens.
Sure.
Boring in the fact that I didn't enjoy it.
Sure.
But the movie progresses.
Yeah, the movie's fine.
There are scenes in it and people act in it. But my first thought as things were done, I was like, okay, I'm now officially 50-50 on Olivia Colman performances, because this was just like...
Pfft. Really?
Yeah. I didn't get it.
I thought she was all right.
Okay.
It was better than... What was the one we saw with Dakota Johnson?
The Lost Daughter. Ooh. Is another one that puts in the negative column.
That
for
one's
her.
Rough.
Yes. So I'm that's where I'm 50-50. I've seen four of her movies now.
Okay.
Well, actually, I think I've seen six of them. Okay. But I only liked three. So
gotcha.
Let's talk about some of those.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Because you of course you recognize Olivia Colman by now. She's quite popular and famous, not only across the pond but here in the States. She plays Hillary, but you might recognize the face, Olivia Colman's face, as the Oscar-winning actress from Yorgos Lanthimos' The Favourite.
Yes.
Playing Queen Anne. She has a history of playing queens.
She plays a lot of queens.
Yes, she's done a lot of queens in her time. She was also Oscar-nominated recently for The Father opposite Anthony Hopkins, which is a plus in her column. The Lost Daughter, which you just mentioned, Sam, she's also Oscar nominated for, which
shocking
was weird. That movie is bad.
Uh-huh.
But of course she won an Emmy for playing Queen Elizabeth in The Crown.
Yes,
that's probably where most people recognize her from. If you're not into prestige British drama, you might be in prestige British television. And she won an Emmy for that. But she also had small stints in Fleabag, Broadchurch, and The Night Manager. So again, prestige British television,
right,
is her wheelhouse. I don't know if you recognized this picture that she was in that we have a connection to called Them That Follow. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
We saw this at the 2019 Traverse City Film Festival.
Wow, that had been, like, it was such a forgettable movie that I forgot about.
I don't
it.
Even remember what it is. I just remember there were snakes in it. I remember
it's
looking,
got Caitlin Dever in it too, right?
Yes, yes. I remember and Jim Gaffigan, I think, is in
yes,
it.
Yes, the dad is Jim Gaffigan.
I was looking through her filmography and I saw the title. I was like, that's that horror movie that is about the woman with the bending and the leg broken on the beach.
That's It Follows.
Yeah. Which is not the same thing. And I was like, Olivia Colman was in a prestige horror movie?
That would kick ass, and I would never forget that.
Yeah, but it was not. And then I looked at it, I was like, oh, I did see that, and I don't remember anything about it. It was like some weird Appalachia religious cult.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was like one of the churches that has the snake venom.
Yes.
And like,
yes.
Snake handlers.
Right. I remember being super excited to go to watch this movie with you and Kate, and then we were all let down from it at the end. And I clearly don't remember a thing about it.
I honestly don't know if there's a twist or anything that happens in the movie.
I can tell you that the movie is called Them That Follow,
yes.
And Olivia Colman is
and
in it.
There's a snake in it.
Yes, there's a snake in it. But let's talk about Hillary, the character, because Hillary herself is admittedly mentally ill. Yes. She's accused of being schizophrenic by her boss in a fit of rage, which I guess tracks. I mean,
yeah, I don't know if that's like the diagnosed
right
what she has,
because we're thinking about medication 40 years ago. She's prescribed lithium. by her psychiatrist, which could be for a number of things, or who knows what they prescribed lithium mm-hmm. for then or what they do now. I don't know. She seemed, I guess her symptoms appeared to be more bipolar than anything.
Yeah.
But then there was writing on the wall, which makes you think that she was having some sort of voices, maybe, perhaps.
Right, which wasn't there for a while, but we realized that she started doing that after she stopped taking the lithium.
Clearly, she's been through this process before. She's had mental breaks. She's been treated. Mm-hmm. And she is now off her medication. Halfway through the movie, she decides to go off it because she's found a new romance and she's doing better. But clearly, she is not better. But as you mentioned in the brief plot summary there, she's a duty manager, which is British for middle management. So she basically has someone above her and someone below her. And in most ways, the answer is yes.
Oh, the way Ian just looked at me by he was so proud of himself right there.
There's so much sexual tension in this movie. I can't wait to talk more about it.
There's way more sex in this movie than I anticipated.
More than there should have been. but she's this middle manager at a local, formerly elegant and perpetually horny movie house.
Yep.
Which is, we'll talk more about the setting here in a second. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But she's currently in the midst of an affair with her boss that appears to be more a solution to her loneliness, I guess, as a character than it is for sexual gratification. Like she's not getting anything out of this.
Yeah, she doesn't
positive.
Seem like she's having too much fun with it.
No, it's not good. She is seemingly self-aware. I think she's aware that she is mentally ill. She also is aware that she's boring and not really interesting. She's mm-hmm. She stays by herself a lot. She eats alone.
Yeah.
She's on the periphery of all the young people that work at the theater.
Right.
I think the thing that was telling to me that she's self-aware is that she readily awaits to be taken away to the psych ward by the social worker.
Yeah.
When they knock her door down, she's ready and waiting and she's prepared to go.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't put up a fight or anything like that. She is basically our central conduit from the audience to the story, but she's one of those unreliable narrators because we don't really know what her motivation is.
Sure.
We struggle to kind of understand where she's coming from, but that could be part of her mental illness or part of the terrible writing that the movie has. The biggest challenge with the character of Hillary is that she doesn't really change throughout. She has a lot of stuff happen to her, mm-hmm. but she doesn't really do anything. There's no arc to the character.
Yeah, and I don't know if we should be... it's because it's a movie, we should be expecting an arc, of course.
Right.
But I'm just saying, in reality, due to her symptoms or what she's being prescribed, can we really expect an arc here? I don't know. Maybe she is really just taking into account what has happened
right.
in the last year or so.
Well, arcs can go backwards, too. She can she can regress.
Which she does at one point.
She does, but it's constantly. Like, it seems the movie seems to be more...
It's going up and down a lot.
Yeah, her performance is more like an amalgamation of emotions than it is something that's well thought out from start to finish.
Sure.
The best way I can describe this is, I think of her performance as like a television show on CBS. Starts out really strong, and then, like, they keep trying to jump the shark to keep it relevant, and she keeps doing different random things to keep it entertaining.
Okay.
As opposed to, I prefer like a Vince Gilligan style where he has the whole show in pictures
There's
from the
plan,
start
yeah.
and charts it out. So that's what I kind of thought throughout the whole thing. It made me think, what is this performance? Because she is all over the place.
But I think that's kind of the point, right? She's supposed to be all over the place.
You could say that because she's playing someone who's mentally ill, but that's also a poor excuse for bad acting.
I guess.
And I don't know if it's her fault. I think mostly it's the script's fault.
I don't think she's doing that poorly.
She's not. It did not feel like... Maybe it's because I'm used to her in her element is either being serious or comedic.
Yeah.
Not both.
Sure.
And she was all over the place here.
Yeah. But like even in The Favorite, she goes off the deep end a couple of times, but it somehow works.
But it's
so well.
It's controlled chaos.
Okay.
And this one just felt like chaos. Like there were some scenes where she was happy, some scenes where she was very sad, some scenes where she was angry. Like I get we're seeing the full emotions of a character, mm-hmm. but there was nothing that prepared us for that next step.
Yeah.
Nothing really justified
her choices. Well,
and
I don't think
choices.
Anything prepared the people that she was interacting with either.
Yeah. You could be making
I maybe
sense.
I'm trying to find things, but I like Steven would have had no idea why he got screamed at about making fun of that older man.
Right.
Like, wouldn't have seen it coming a mile away.
Right. I don't know. I was just surprised that people were really attracted to this performance, because I was not. And from the very beginning, I was not.
I hate it.
I did love the lipstick on her teeth, though. I thought that was well done. Because it was cringy. It was so cringy.
Well, that whole scene was so cringy.
That was the best scene in the whole movie, but it added to the cringe, so I had to give them credit for that. But tell us a little bit more about some of the other performances in here, because she basically hates all men, but is willing to endorse a couple of them.
Yes, and the first one, and probably the highest endorsement, goes to Michael Ward playing Steven.
Mm-hmm.
You may know Steven from Netflix crime drama Top Boy, which I've never heard of before in my life.
Nope.
Steve McQueen's Lovers Rock, one of Steve McQueen's BBC Small Acts anthology series of films, which got BAFTA nominated.
Was BAFTA nominated, yeah.
Oh, he mm-hmm. himself was. Mm-hmm. Cool. Those eight movies, or how many?
Right. It was from 2020. No one really knew what they were. They were full-length movies, most of them, but they were billed as television, so they were not Oscar eligible, but they were BAFTA eligible.
Okay.
So weird.
Yeah, it's just a weird way to market, just because, like, you could have just put out six separate movies and you're Steve McQueen. It probably would have done even better.
Right. This one was Lover's Rock was one of the favorite of the group, though.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
He was the winner of the BAFTA Rising Star Award in 2020.
It's basically the best young star.
Nice.
It's awesome. It's popular.
Mm-hmm. And he was nominated for his third BAFTA for his role as Steven in Empire of Light. So he got nominated for this. And honestly, I thought he was pretty good.
Yeah.
I thought he did really well in this one. Steven as a character, though, is a dapper young black man, son of a single mother who is a nurse in the nearby hospital. He's newly hired at the Empire Theater after failing to qualify for college. He wants to become an architect. He has those big, big dreams of going to college, maybe going to a big city. But in his heart, he's a true romantic.
Yeah. Nothing special about him in my mind.
He's incredibly sweet. Yes. There's nothing to make him really stand out. But being a handsome guy in a small town, that'll do the trick, right?
That worked. That was all he needed. And he went to work at a movie theater because romance.
Yes.
Yes. And so he's the good guy. Yes. Who's the bad guy?
The bad guy
in Hillary's life,
who disappears halfway through the movie, is Colin Thankfully. Firth as Donald Ellis. You may
Mr. Ellis.
You may recognize Mr. Firth from the Bridget Jones franchise, the Kingsman franchise, which he is excellent in. I did not know this. The Mamma Mia franchise.
He is a franchise actor. I had no idea.
That either. Is crazy.
When I started listing him, I was like, oh, that's weird.
He was Oscar nominated for the role of in Tom Ford's A Serious Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he is an Oscar winning actor as King George VI. In the King's Speech, which made me smile because the speech he gives in front of the theater made me think of the King's Speech.
I wouldn't have Jeffrey Rush up there going, Bertie! fuck, shit. Shit and tits.
This is all staying in. Because if you've seen the movie, it will be more relevant for you.
Yeah, it wasn't just cursing for the sake of cursing. I was quoting him.
I just wanted to make sure it was clear for anybody listening. Mr. Ellis, though, as a character, is a dick. He's an asshole. he's
and that's it.
That's really kind of what it is. He's the theater manager of the Empire Theater, and he's really just there to take advantage of his employees.
Right.
Both in making them do more work than maybe they need to be doing and sexually gratifying him.
Yeah,
into a teacup, which we learn is he gets jerked off into a teacup.
As one does.
As one, I guess, does.
Yeah. So there's nothing here. This character is such a waste for him.
And he has nothing to do.
No.
He stands around and looks frustrated. Like, that's all he really has to do in this movie.
Right.
And that's so disappointing for somebody with his kind of talent.
Right. Speaking of underutilized talent.
Jesus Christ, yes.
The supporting cast includes the criminally underutilized Toby Jones, who basically is on screen to spew empty platitudes about the magic of movies and play with old projection systems, as well as Tom Brooke and Tanya Moody, who are both British film and theater actors.
Nice.
So, it's just sad. The writing is so bad. I'm sorry. Doesn't give a chance for enough of these characters to breathe sure. anything or to do anything. And you have a brilliant casting director that cast perfect people, just mm-hmm. the roles are not good enough for them.
Yeah, there could have been more, especially Toby Jones, because honestly, if we're going to our favorite things here,
yes,
all things Norman was my favorite. He was my favorite character in the movie.
How? He's on screen for like 5 seconds.
Exactly. I just like everything with the projectors. I thought everything there was really
movie
beautiful.
Magic porn.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it worked on me. It's Oscar bait, and it fucking worked on me. Him talking about the beam of light, and they're Steven saying like, "Man, I didn't expect them to be so big." Talking about the projectors themselves.
Ayo.
And he's like, "You don't want the people to know how big they are. They should just see a beam of light." And I'm like, that's a bad line.
Yeah.
But I
fell for it.
I fell for it and I liked
it. The movie is masturbatory theater at the best.
Yeah. You're right.
But what other, you already talked about teacups. Did you have another tea line that
you
enjoyed?
I did have a tea line that I enjoyed. And that also came from Colin Firth talking about how his wife, they're no longer in love. And
Brenda.
Brenda, the biggest cut to his heart is she won't even make me a cup of tea anymore.
Will he ever survive?
The most British problem I've ever heard in my entire life.
A lot of their problems in history revolve around tea.
So much of them.
It's really
so
sad.
So much of them.
It's sad that that plays such a role.
And then I love the scene where Steven is learning how to switch over from one projector to another. Mm-hmm. And they're showing him like the blips that are happening on screen and like, oh, you need to flip this switch. You need to change that thing. I honestly knew some of this stuff because mm-hmm. a part of it was talked about in Fight Club, like the stuff in the corner of the screen. But I didn't know how much effort went into it for the projectionists themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by that now.
It seems like you need to go to the Academy Museum, Sam.
Yes, I do.
Learn a little bit more about that.
I sure do.
Well, I didn't have a lot that I really enjoyed, but there were a couple things that I took somewhat pleasure in.
Don't get too excited here.
There's a scene where Hillary takes Steven to what appears to be like a pool along the beach.
It looked like a retaining
right
thing or something.
And people were swimming in it, so I assume it's a pool.
Sure.
But she takes him there to cure racism as a whole and to assuage her bystanding white guilt by skipping stones, mm-hmm. As one does. And I like when she kind of says, hey, I'm going to show you something I'm incredibly good at, because that's how you justify pulling someone away from a racist situation. And then she like pretends to teach him how to throw stones, and then it gets to her beat her turn. She says, I lied, I'm shit-headed.
And she just tosses one in.
Which is, I think, funny, I guess. I loved her mental break at the film premiere of Chariots of Fire, which I thought was just drama-filled and...
True drama.
And well acted. I think I'll give her credit for that scene. Yeah,
reading her poem.
Right, the poem with the lipstick on the teeth. I actually loved her interaction with Brenda in the lobby of the
yes,
cinema.
Yes, to fuck really or not to fuck.
Right. I thought that was creative. way to pull from Bill Shakespeare there, Sam Mendes. Wow, stretch real hard. There was another comic part that I kind of giggled at. When the police and social worker beat down Hillary's door to take her away to the psych ward, they like the door falls and goes poof. Mm-hmm. And then the social worker goes, may we come in?
Yeah. Which is also very British.
very British. as this was kind of funny element, one thing that didn't make sense to me was they chose to play Cat Stevens' Morning Has Broken throughout that scene.
Oh,
which
okay.
doesn't make sense to me because, granted, it kind of fits the music style, but not really, because he's talking, Steven's talking more about like new age stuff and ska and like new things. Mm-hmm. And Cat Stevens was like, 20 years before that, before the 80s period of time. And this is like an old Scottish children's hymn that he adapted, talking about how light breaking and beauty and all that stuff.
So
and I was like, this is her darkest scene.
Yeah, they went for the title of the movie, sticking with the light theme.
Perhaps. Like, the tonally doesn't fit because it's kind of a folky rhyme, like nursery rhyme kind of song. And it doesn't fit. Like, I was expecting like some very dark scoring to fall here as we had throughout the rest of the movie.
There's some very literal needle drops in this movie too. Like,
yeah.
We see the needle drop on like several songs.
This is where I struggled, and we'll get to this on technical side, but I love the score of the movie. I didn't like the soundtrack. So okay. The songs they chose to layer in, I thought didn't fit well.
I thought that, like, lyrically they were all very on the nose yes. for what was happening, but they didn't fit tonally.
Tonally, correct. You're exactly yeah. right. Because Joni Mitchell can fit in any movie, mm-hmm. but tonally, the harmonica was not falling in to this time. Okay, wasn't
right,
getting it.
Right.
And then another thing I loved was Mr. Ellis's dirty talk that I wanted to share with all of the listeners in case they missed it. As he's preparing to ravish her against the desk in his office, he just is preparing for the moment by saying, "You're so helpful. I feel such tenderness towards you. Your ass feels so good in my hands."
Hot.
I don't know about you, Sam, but I'm bricked up just thinking about it.
Hot.
I just,
also very British.
I feel such tenderness towards you. I'm going to use that.
You should.
I think that's a real romance building line right there.
Oh my God.
But let's move into that technical side because this is rightfully where the film has been recognized.
Absolutely.
But tell us some of your favorite things technically, Sam.
First of all, Roger Deakins has no business going this hard for a movie so average. This movie is stunningly shot.
Yeah.
The lighting is perfect on every scene. So many could just be photographs, honestly.
His framing is beautiful.
It's perfect. The shots even, like, I don't even really care for firework shots, but the shots of the firework on New Year's Eve are what everyone thinks they're getting on their phone when they're filming them. Like, that's the feeling that they're like, oh, I'm making art right now filming right. these fireworks. No. Roger Deakins is fucking making art with that.
Okay, but though fireworks are just inherently cinematic.
They are, but when filmed properly and framed properly.
And laid over a fake front scene.
Yeah, that helps too.
Yeah.
As far as a technical choice, the mm-hmm. setting itself.
Yes, let's talk about
Empire
it.
Empire Theater, I want to live in it. I want to make it my life's work. It is stunning. It's perfect. It's one of the most beautiful sets I've ever seen.
And it's all fake. That's the cool part.
That upsets me. But I want it to be real because I want to sleep on the floor. I don't care.
Upstairs.
Anywhere.
Exposed to the elements.
Yes, with the pigeons.
That's the thing I thought was so cool about it was, yes, the entryway is beautiful. And it reminded me a lot of Bad Times at the El Royale. Remember
Ooh,
the lobby
yeah.
of that hotel?
Yes.
It felt very much like that style, mm-hmm. you know, the very bold and bright colors.
So much red.
Right. Yeah. And I love the contrast of the red of the walls and then in the screen, the blue chairs. Mm-hmm. I love that contrast. But yeah, as I mentioned, they created this. The theater exists.
Yes, the exterior.
Exterior exists and they basically renovated the whole thing to make what it appears in the film. But the thing that blew me away was I've had dreams where I like open a door and walk into an entirely new bunch of house, or I don't know how to say what I'm saying.
Like a new portion of your house
right.
exists after opening
right.
a door.
And it's three times the size
sure.
of my own house. It's like out of the box in Disney Channel, right?
Sure.
You walk into that thing and it's like a huge clubhouse.
What a weird reference, but I love
that's
it.
That's what I was going for. But that's what, like, when she took him upstairs into the screens 3 and 4,
yeah.
in the lounge. I was like, how do you let something that beautiful go that badly?
Yeah.
Like,
they probably just couldn't sell enough tickets for that. I don't know why it looked like apocalyptic.
Right.
That was crazy to me.
The roof doesn't just cave in on a place like that.
No. And that I didn't understand. I can understand them having to shut it down because it's no longer
close
in
it.
Use. Yeah. But yeah, every the carpet was ripped out. Everything was all cement. And,
right.
And then the amount of pigeons in the lounge area,
right.
which is the best part of this whole space, is this huge lounge and like fixed up. I was disappointed by the end of this movie that it wasn't fixed up.
Right. It was begging for it.
It was begging to look beautiful by the end
of
this.
Did you want like the Titanic shot where they like zoom across the sunken boat and it turns back into
beautiful? Yes. I would have loved that
uh-huh.
so much.
Roger Deakins doesn't do that shit.
No, it's tacky as hell, but I would have liked it.
See, the thing I struggled with was the different scenes of this movie take place in two different worlds because the theater itself is very 50s, 60s inspired, mm-hmm. if not sooner. And then the outside is like grungy 80s, like
yeah,
side of the road British stuff.
Yeah, the brick exterior did seem kind of like run down. It didn't really quite fit.
Well, not the even the theater, just like the aesthetic of that town.
Oh, the space. Did, yeah.
Like, I couldn't tell. Like, if you didn't tell me this was in the 80s, I wouldn't have guessed that was the era it was in.
Yeah, it could have been any time for
right.
me.
It
honestly, though, some of the exterior stuff during, like, the summertime was beautiful. Like,
yes.
Some of the under bridges and all that stuff was really cool, too.
Mm-hmm. No, they did a good job capturing what was there.
Yeah.
They made a very unbeautiful place beautiful, mm-hmm. but I think that's Roger Deakins' skill. The sound design is one thing I wanted to note was the particular scene where the White Power Parade, they come up and they invade. I don't really call that other than an invasion, I guess, or it's not a B&E, but
a little riot.
A riot. But they turn on the...
Vandalism,
I
don't know.
Right, yeah. They turn on the theater and then they try to break in. And the whole movie had been very subtle until that point. Mm-hmm. But I remember listening to this on the big screen speaker that I was watching.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like intense and bombastic.
Dangerous.
And it just really felt out of place with the rest of the movie, but I was drawn into it.
Sure.
Because that scene...
Especially the guy dancing on top of the... I don't know what that was. The snack bar. He
right.
was just like doing this weird dance moves.
There was a lot of weird dancing in the movie at various times and places. But yeah, I thought the sound design, I like when it's subtle and then it gets big. But mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand this scene of the movie because we went from like zero to Nazi in like 5 seconds. And I know that's possible now. It just didn't feel right in the movie to
right.
me.
Okay. That's
but
fair.
Just some minor gripes. That anything else fair. Technically stood out to you?
Yeah, one. This movie is beating you over the head with its messaging, and it's not very subtle in what it's trying to do. And one of the most like egregious versions of this was Steven immediately after meeting Hillary mm-hmm. for the first time, maybe 4 minutes in, he grabs a pigeon with a broken wing and proceeds to fix said pigeon.
Yeah. Cue Martina McBride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, but he's going to do that with Hillary now. Like, she has the broken wing, and he is going to fix her. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. It's too on the nose.
I think what you're missing, Sam, is that ornithology gets people horny.
Oh.
And I've said this to you for years, and you've declined
it. You have. I was like, I don't believe you.
You've denied it, and here is
but
now evidence.
But I've seen it happen with Olivia Colman, and I'm like, it's probably true now.
Yes. This leads me to one of my questions overall, because I have many.
Okay,
let's
hear some questions.
First of all, the romance between the two of them, how does it form? Because they spend one scene as a tour, like her giving him a tour of the place.
Yes.
The next scene, and that's where they find the bird.
They fix the bird. Yep.
And they don't fix it. He just like puts it in the sleeve
puts
and like
it in
sets
a sock.
It there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing romantic happens there. They're just kind of like touring the place.
Mm-hmm.
The next scene, she's yelling at him for mocking somebody. In the next scene, they're fucking. So I just really didn't get, like, is it a love-hate thing?
I don't think it's a love-hate thing. I think she clearly has a crush on him.
But for what?
Because he's handsome? I don't know. I don't know what the reasoning is.
Okay.
And because he's sweet to animals, and I'm assuming that's part of it, too. But, yeah, I think they first kiss during New Year's.
Right. Super awkward.
She kisses him, says shit, and runs away.
Yeah, and then we never talk about it again.
Yeah.
Then they're just like at a roller rink socializing.
Like the shortest one scene montage I've ever seen. But, oh, no, they go to the roller rink and then a carnival.
Right.
But as like a group of three.
Right.
With one of the other employees that's
right.
there.
The punk girl.
Yeah. And I guess that's us determining like, oh, he's more interested in Hillary than the punk girl.
He's interested in a lot of people throughout
the
movie.
He keeps inviting her.
And I was watching this with my friend Taylor, and he goes, oh, I hope he's not, like, using her. I hope he's not using her. And I kept thinking, like, well, what is his motivation with her at all?
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, I don't really find her attractive in a way that I would want to fuck her after the first day of meeting her. And I don't understand her motivation to like him either. So we had this super awkward kiss, which would have been fine if mm-hmm. we either A, talked about it, or like we cut to the montage of her like viewing him from a distance for a while. So it like makes it awkward. But she like runs away, and then he looks at the fireworks, and then all of a sudden they're romantically engaged. And I don't understand that jump.
But she was also like very like at the scene at the carnival, she's incredibly supportive of his dreams.
Okay.
And I think that's got to be part of it.
Okay.
Where she is like, you have to go after it. You if you want to do something, you need to be able to do it and get out of here. And he that's the only time he really takes that to heart. And I think that's got to be at least part of it.
Okay. I don't I don't get
it's
it.
It's a stretch, but I'm kind of with you on that.
Okay. My second question is, what does this movie have to say about race or racism?
It exists. Like, honestly, that's what it feels
that's
like.
That's what I got. Here's the dialogue to go. Let's go to the receipts. He's in the hospital bed after being beaten up by the white mob. And he says, it happened to my mom. It happened to me. It'll probably happen to my children. Sometimes I think, what's the fucking point? And she's like, yeah, I agree.
She doesn't say anything. That's it. Yeah,
And he, like, every chance that he brings up a chance to talk about race in a way, she is just kind of like sitting there and
she has nothing to say.
She shouldn't, but she doesn't, she doesn't like acknowledge him in any way that's supportive.
Yeah.
Even when he, and I agree with Sam Mendes a little credit here because he brings up some historical elements that give us some context. So Stephen brings up the New Cross Fire and the Brixton Riots, which were, I Googled them because I was curious. They just are thrown away in the movie.
Yeah.
The New Cross Fire was a fire at a house party that killed 13 young black men that was suspected arson by the people in the community, okay. The black people in the community, and there were never any, they never ruled it an arson. There were no arrests. And the basically the white population decided just forget about it.
Sure.
And that led to the riots that he then mentioned. So this is all happening in, the fire was in January of 81, and then the riots
so
were
around the
later.
Same time.
Right. So it's referencing the same period of time. But this made me think of, one, that would be a better movie, is talking about that.
About either of those things.
Right.
Yes.
Two, reminded me of the Upstairs Lounge Fire, which was 1973, so about 10 years earlier, that killed 32 gay men in New Orleans. And
wow.
I've never heard people talk about this. I don't know if there are any movies about it.
I don't think I've ever heard of it.
This one, there were no arrests as well, but arson was proven
in
this case, that someone basically set fire to a gay nightclub and killed all these people. So much so that two of the bodies were never even identified. They don't even know who they were. And it's a sad story. The worst mass killing at a gay nightclub until Pulse, more recently in our life, 2016. So it just, I was like, these are movies of stories that could be told instead of talking about the periphery of two people that aren't really reflecting on them more than mentioning them.
Right.
And that was kind of frustrating to me. Just brought that up.
And Hillary as a character never engages any further than just listening.
No.
And I'm not saying she needs to lecture on it or anything like that, but she could become a little bit more involved as a character and just doesn't.
Well, she just stands by him. Like, it'd be one thing if she was listening that whole time, and then she has a moment where she's justifiably defending him, and even in her defense of him, she doesn't do anything.
It's very weak.
And then when
she tries to stop him from getting beat up, she gets pushed on the ground, and that's
right. And she allows the racist incident with that regular filmgoer or moviegoer to happen all the time, or that happened right in front of her, and it's just really weird, that scene where he like eats in front of him because he prevents him from going in the theater with his food that he brought in,
and it lasts for a long time,
way too long. The movie doesn't say anything about race that gives us anything to think about. It just says, this is 1980 in Britain, and it was racist, and we move on. Oh, by the way, there's Nazis that are going to invade the theater. That's the central location of this movie, and nothing's going to happen from that. Like, everything felt very just kind of thrown on the screen, and nothing ever developed with that story. So that was confusing to me. Ultimately, my question still remains, why are they romantically inclined? Because what does he do for her? He doesn't give her anything.
Yeah, but also gives stability.
And
someone, I think the same thing that Stephen was looking for was support. They were both there for each other with no real motivations as to why. Like, they're just kind of there for each other.
Okay.
Because Ellis was clearly looking for something out of the relationship with Hillary, and was kind of court mandated to be there, we find out at one point, to look after. To look after her. This situation, both are getting significantly supported with no ulterior motives.
Okay. I just didn't think that he was lacking support. I mean, he didn't qualify for school. It's not like people said, you'll never be in school. His mom was always supporting him. His ex-girlfriend was always supporting him.
Yep.
So I was just confused as to, you know, what brought them together.
Sure.
But here's a thing I'd said, if I could make the movie a little bit better, because this occurred to me about halfway through, is Stephen even real? That was the first question I had. Don't hate me.
Ian McNeil.
Don't hate me. But I was thinking about it for a while, and it was the scene where Social Services comes to her, and she tells him to go hide in the cabinet or in the closet or something. They come in. They don't know he's there, and he stays there. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you stay there? And the scene cuts away with him still in the cabinet. Mm-hmm. And then I caught thinking, well, has he ever talked to anyone else throughout the movie? Because
Ian McNeil.
So maybe it would not be better if he was actually like some figment of her imagination or a voice that she was hearing.
It would be so much worse. I do understand where you're coming from on this idea. I think what it would say about mental illness would be so much worse than the little it says already to make his character a figment of her imagination.
You know what makes saying little even worse? Saying more. That's how bad the screenwriting is.
I think that would be, a ridiculous cliche.
Fair.
For him to be a figment of her imagination.
Among many other cliches in the movie.
Of so many. But also, I'm like, oh, that would be brutal the little that they say about mental health.
Okay. Fair. last thing here that's a little bit more just on the nose. Why do they take a bus to the beach when they live on the coast? Like, this just really kind of threw me, was they, because then I didn't think anything of it until his mom later said, were you the one that went to the beach with him? Mm-hmm. And I was like, you live across the street from a beach.
I can see the water in this scene right now.
And it made me think, okay, so Kent is on the east side of England, which is basically the English Channel side, the side that borders Europe. So maybe the beach to UK people is like the ocean side.
Sure.
So they took a bus across England.
It also makes me think maybe their beach sucks. Like it seemed a little more industrial over there. Maybe it's like the people that go from New York City because they can see the ocean to Lake Florida when they're you can go to a nice beach.
Yeah, it just seemed like an unnecessary trip.
It was
for
silly.
Them.
And how is that bus making money? There was nobody on it. And I know they were on the upper level, but like, where is everybody?
Clearly it was not the summer season.
Yeah, high quality beach going day.
And if you're from the UK, please let us know if the beach means the ocean side.
Yeah.
This is only an assumption.
Sure.
And I would
We're
assume.
We're just making a guess.
I don't know how long it takes. It's a big country. I would assume it takes some time to go to the beach.
Yeah, it would take a few hours to get to one side to the other.
I don't know.
It does seem silly.
British people don't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But Sam, the time has come for you to slam the ever living Britishness out of this movie.
I'm so happy to do it with my Sam Slam.
Slam it. Go ahead.
First thing is like one of the first shots of the movie. That popcorn would be so fucking stale if it was there from the night before.
And it was full.
It was full. You got to empty that shit. You need new fresh popcorn in there. Did everybody in the 80s just eat stale popcorn? Because that sounds miserable.
I will say, I prefer stale popcorn.
How stale?
Like the next day popcorn.
Next day popcorn.
I do enjoy, I enjoy it smooth.
I'd be upset.
Smooth. What's the word? Opposite of crunchy.
Soft?
Soft. I enjoy it tempered.
I enjoy it smooth. I just needed to point out, and we've already said it though, what a strange way to jerk off Colin Firth.
Of all the jerking off positions that you could choose.
The weirdest one was chosen. It was so weird. It was so weird.
You have two Oscar-winning actors, and you're going to make them do this weird, like, triangle version of a standing up jerking off scene.
And we don't see it, but we find out that it ends up in a teacup, which is even weirder. Such a strange scene. And then we talked about the bird already, but also I want to say, don't touch the pigeon, you idiot. Pigeons are gross. They're disgusting.
They're living inside a building.
Yeah, it's so gross. And then later, and I don't know if it was this scene or the scene that they let him go. Mm-hmm. It might be the scene that they let the pigeon fly out the window. Steven takes his hand that was just holding the pigeon and is now touching Hillary's cheek.
I think he does more with his hand than that, Sam.
He does. It's disgusting.
If you're going to finger your girlfriend
wash your hands.
Wash your hands first.
Get some hand sanny on that stuff. Oh my God. Oh, so gross.
Oh my God.
Speaking of the trip to the beach, we talked about that.
Yes.
Steven had so far to run to get to the water. Oh, my God. He's like, I'm going to run there. And he's like running.
It's 300 yards away.
It made me think of the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail where they're storming the castle and you see it running closer and closer and then it starts way further back again. It's so far away.
Oh.
One thing I noticed, and it might be a British thing or just an old building thing, the door to Hillary's flat, and I'm going to use the British term flat instead of apartment.
Immersion.
Has locks but no doorknob. Locks, it did, no it didn't have a doorknob. It had like a chain lock and a couple of other locks.
Oh.
But it did not have a doorknob that you turn to get into the building.
Interesting.
And I was so confused. I was like, how would it latch if you don't lock everything?
Like, there's Is this like the door to her actual apartment or the door to the building?
The one they knocked down. The one that they knocked down has no doorknob. Maybe that's
why they did it. So they can knock it down.
I guess. I don't know.
So just basically they just have a deadbolt but no doorknob.
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't paying attention that close.
I saw it twice, so I was seeing everything. But I just, and maybe that's a British thing. Maybe it's something about older buildings.
Yeah, maybe British people don't have doorknobs.
Do you have doorknobs over there in the UK?
Interesting, because that's a primary insult for the UK people to use.
Calling them a knob?
You're a doorknob. Yeah, you're a knob. I don't think that's what it means, but...
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Beg to differ.
Okay, there is also a scene that happens near the end of the movie where Hillary gets to meet Ruby, okay, for the first
time.
Yes,
the other woman.
The other woman, Steven introduces Ruby to Hillary.
Let's make it clear that Steven did not introduce her. He tries to leave Ruby far away from her.
Yeah, they don't want
that. And Ruby comes wandering back because she just has to meet her.
Yeah, and it took too long. but we see Hillary sitting on a bench in full winter clothing. She has a winter hat on. She has a big old jacket. She is bundled up. When Ruby walks up, she's just hanging out in a short sleeve dress. What is the temperature in the UK? That makes no sense to me.
You think Michigan weather is unpredictable? There, it changes by the foot that you are standing in.
Three steps closer, Ruby would have gotten frostbite.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it seemed windy. So, it was so confusing to me on the attire in that particular scene.
My only way to justify that would be that Hillary is back from a psych ward, and she might just be bundled up because she's... looking for protection from her clothing.
Maybe. That's actually an in-depth look at something that I didn't give enough thought to.
I know
you're just pulling it out of your ass right now. But
that was not to challenge your slam.
Sure.
Your slam is indeed warranted.
And then I got a couple more things.
Please.
Anytime I hear a story in a script that begins with, when I was little, my dad or my mom, I completely zone out. Those stories suck. They're never good.
Where did that? Is that how it started the movie?
No, it was a story back in the theater toward the end of the movie. Hillary is talking to Steven at one point while sitting where she eats her lunch up at the top of the steps.
Uh-huh.
And she talks about going fishing with her dad.
Ah, right. And I was like, they never caught anything.
I don't give a shit. Like, if you start a story that way, it's bad screenwriting and you should never do it.
Yeah.
I hate it.
So you're saying there was bad screenwriting in the movie?
I am saying there was bad screenwriting in the movie.
Yep.
And then my last one is about the racists. Racists are dumb. Okay? I want to point that out. But
Sam Mendes is saying that they were smart or intelligent.
No, I'm just I need everyone to know this.
Okay, ground level.
Racists are dumb.
Okay, got it.
But racists on scooters are dumb and adorable.
I had no idea what this was. When they heard the sound.
Yeah.
And they go out.
Of thundering, thundering engines revving up.
The Vespas were vibing. They were just taken to the streets.
I could tell what they were as soon as they started going by, but I was like, aw, look at all those little scooters.
It's definitely not the riots of Charlottesville that we have.
Yeah, and when you think racist in America, you think motorcycle. You don't think scooter.
Is that what you think?
I don't know.
Wow, you just demonized the whole population.
Whole population of motorcycle drivers. No, I'm just thinking like big like Harley Davidson shit and like something that's really actually gonna make a noise.
Racist.
Yeah. Yeah. Racists. You know what I'm talking about.
If you drive something with two wheels, racist.
Oh, no. All right. Okay. Let's move on to our critical reception here when it comes to Empire of Light.
Yeah, Sam, tell us about the numbers for this one.
We have an IMDb audience score of a 6.6 out of 10. That's with 14,000 ratings. Mm-hmm. We have a Metascore of a 54 out of 100. Rotten Tomatoes critic score of a 45%. And an audience score of a 74%. Wow.
Surprising there.
Surprisingly high. We have a box office of $9.3 million.
That's globally. No one here saw it. It's all British money.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. We do have a critical consensus that Empire of Light contains some fine performances and a few flashes of brilliance, but this tribute to the magic of cinema is disappointingly mundane.
Is it a tribute to the magic of cinema?
No, it's not. Which is even weirder about this movie is they want you to like talk about how great movie. They want to go like full Fablemans with how much cinema changes the world.
Right.
And honestly, it's just kind of the backdrop for two weird stories.
Right.
Yeah.
That are totally disconnected.
Yeah. It's the setting. I never thought like I know that's why Toby Jones was in this was to like try to like, hey, see, it's still about movies, but like it doesn't really work.
I saw a really good criticism piece for this that said Toby Jones is like Shakespeare. Every British director asks Toby or not Toby because he's in almost everything.
Yes.
And I love that. Are you surprised with a 45% critic score?
Honestly, no. Okay. I think it's heavy handed in the messaging it does try to get across. And I think, yeah, it's not a good movie, but it fits there. I can see people hating it. Mm-hmm. I can see people being completely indifferent on it and giving it a completely average score.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see a ton of people like full on loving it on the critic side of things.
Okay, is Empire of Light successful if Roger Deakins is not part of it?
No.
Okay.
It fails miserably.
Okay. Well, let's talk about its under-the-radar-ness then, and why we're talking about it in the first place. Because you would think a movie with this lineup of people on the technical side and these actors would be huge. Mm-hmm. Just saying Olivia Colman and Colin Firth in Britain sends everyone into collective orgasm, right? but I wanted to look at the Oscar baitness of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's just take a look at some of the top people in the movie and their relation to Oscar. So Sam Mendes, who produced, wrote, and directed this film, has won an Oscar before on mm-hmm. 4 nominations. Pippa Harris, who is his co-producer, has been nominated before for Best Picture for 1917. She's got a nomination but no wins. Olivia Colman, 1 win for 3 nominations. By the way, she was nominated for Golden Globe for Empire of Light,
okay,
which is bizarre.
More proof that Golden Globes don't know what they're doing.
Which is, again, they're just trying to invite people that they want to get to know.
Sure.
Right? Because she didn't even get a BAFTA nomination. If Olivia Colman cannot get a BAFTA nomination...
Yeah, that's not a good
sign. That's weird. Okay? Colin Firth, 1 for 2, as we mentioned before.
Yes.
Roger Deakins, 2 wins on 16 nominations for the cinematographer.
That's insane. What's his other... what's his wins for?
Wins are for 1917 and Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, two gorgeous movies.
Yes. Yeah. He was one of those people that had been nominated tons of times, never mm-hmm. won, and now is getting the recognition for movies that he deserves.
Yeah.
By the way, this is his 5th collaboration with Sam Mendes. I didn't realize that.
He did both the Bond movies with Mendes too, right?
Yep.
Okay.
The film editor, Lee Smith, has been nominated 3 times, has won once.
Okay.
Alexander Byrne, who did the costume design, has been nominated 6 times and won once.
Well, there's no way in shit that was going to...
Because she was hot and the other one was cold. That's why you're like, Sam, not voting for it. But if you're doing the math there at home, that's 11 wins and 41 nominations in just 8 people.
Yeah.
7 people.
That's crazy.
That's just 7 people in this. Which, and a lot of them are doing double duty here.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the thing that was just surprising to me. This was baited intentionally.
Well, and it's got so many aspects of it that are like, this is Oscar bait.
Right.
It has the racism. I'm just saying, no, like that is an Oscar baity subject matter.
Yes.
It has the choice of using mental illness. Oscar baity subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
It has a full surrounding of film, and it actually shows you clips from better movies in this movie. And I was mm-hmm. like, yeah, a circle jerk around Hollywood and other movies being made. Yeah, that's
with
Oscar
British
bait.
Accents. Yes.
Yes,
that's
please.
It. I think the reason why it was not popular, again, $9.3 million box office, only about 1.5 million of that was here in the States.
Okay.
Most of it was across the pond here. Sure. But I think the problem was Searchlight Pictures got a little overfilled this year. Mm-hmm. Because their big push was for Banshees.
As it should have been.
Which they did. Took it to 9 nominations. 0 wins, though.
Which is disappointing.
Yes.
But a significantly better movie than this.
9 nominations for Banshees. Again, a huge British picture, right? Anything more British than Banshees. Granted, it's Irish, technically. But you know what I'm saying. UK.
Yeah.
Right? And then,
oh, that just offended so many people. It's British. You know what I'm talking about.
Sorry.
Ireland? Yeah, it's British.
It's that stuff.
Jesus.
They speak English. And then they also had The Menu, which was a very popular movie commercially.
Yep.
Not necessarily something that you take to award season, or didn't get the awards recognition.
It deserved a little recognition from somewhere.
But Searchlight, again, if you're unfamiliar, is basically the art house wing of Disney. Mm-hmm. Because it used to be Fox Searchlight. So you had 20th Century Fox, and then you had Fox Searchlight. Fox was always doing the smaller, mm-hmm. more independent art house films. Since Disney bought Fox in that huge acquisition a few years ago, 20th Century Studios is now the more in commercial fare.
Right.
And then Searchlight Pictures is now the kind of art house stuff and the auteur stuff. So I just think they got overwhelmed with their film selection this year. Mm-hmm. This one hit late, didn't even get a wide release. So they did that platform thing that they did. Searchlight did this with Wes Anderson's last movie that we talked about, The French Dispatch.
Oh, yes.
Gave it a really limited... No, they did that one in April. I remember that was a really weird... Like, they had planned this big awards season release for it and then bailed on it and just threw it in the middle of April where everyone forget about it.
Which
except us, because we talked about it
on our episodes.
Yeah. So I just think this was a conscious choice that they acquired the movie and were like, oh, yeah, we actually got a better horse with Banshees and we're just going to run that
better
one.
Better donkey.
It's my donkey shite, not me pony shite. So yeah, so I think this one's under the radar one. It doesn't really, the age demographic does not get young people.
It's not going to pull anybody in.
If you know Michael Ward from the Netflix shows that he's on, they're basically teen dramas, and the Top Boys is more of a crime drama. You're not going to watch him fall in love with Olivia Colman. Like, that's not something you're interested in watching him do. So I don't think his casting brought in a younger demographic.
Right.
And of course, the Olivia Colman Colin Firth brings in the 60 and over demographic, but they're looking for the queen and the king, quite literally, and that's not what they got.
Right.
So I think...
although the audience Rotten Tomatoes score is pretty high. 74% is not anything to sneeze at, really.
Right. And you would think that the casual moviegoer wouldn't appreciate this because it's mostly cinematography that makes it good.
Yeah.
So that's a little surprising to me, but I don't know.
I think it's easy to watch. I don't think it's a tough watch. It's not making you think too hard. It's not. It's
exactly what white people want to talk about as far as these issues.
Oh my God,
racism exists. That's it.
Yeah,
mental illness affects people. That's it.
Jesus,
it's as far as they're willing to go.
Yeah,
and movies are pretty.
God damn it! God damn it!
You're what not a great wrong. Selection that you gave us.
Yeah, I'm honestly not mad that I selected it because it was fun to talk about for sure.
Of course,
but
of course.
Before we get to the end, we need to find out: is it worth your time?
No. The thing that it tells you how bad the movie is, I took note of all the other movies mentioned in it. I would rather watch those.
Ooh, what were the ones that you saw?
So, Blues Brothers, of course. I've seen
Blues Brothers is great.
I've never seen All That Jazz, and I really want to.
Okay.
That was on the marquee with Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
Chariots of Fire, never seen. Mm-hmm. Best Picture winner.
Yep.
Inherently British.
Yeah.
I don't know where it had its regional premiere. It was not at this theater.
Are you sure?
But really, what it made me want to watch is Being There.
Oh,
which is
when
the
Peter Sellers movie.
Yes, directed by Hal Ashby, which again, connection to Harold and Maude.
Harold and Maude.
Which we reviewed on this show.
Yes.
And I'm a huge Hal Ashby fan, but I've never seen this movie. And made me think, okay, if Toby Jones is going to recommend one movie to her. This, by the way, we never talked about the fact that she works in a movie house and doesn't even go to the movies.
Doesn't go to any of the movies.
What a waste. Yeah. And then she says, show me a film.
Which is bullshit. This is the tie-in to movies are great.
Right.
Like, at the end of the movie, you're like, just show me anything. Toby, never mind that Norman... The Toby Jones character is packing up and ready to go home for the night.
He is a union employee.
And then we realize how much work goes into switching the reels for one person.
Yeah. And then she's like, we need to do more midnight screenings. And I was like, think about Toby Jones. He hasn't talked to his son in years.
Yeah, since he was 8. He's 22 now. Jesus. But also, I agree. I loved that Stephen brought up the Pink Panther series.
Yes.
Pink Panther, Peter Sellers movies are some of the best movies, and I have such fond memories of watching them as a kid.
Well, I have no idea what being there is about. I saw Hal Ashby was on it. I was like, yes, sign me up. And that then I shot, saw Peter Sellers like walking over in water. And I was like, sign me up even more.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. Yeah. I think there was another one too, the Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder film, yes. Stir Crazy, yes. was in it too.
And he even thanked Richard Pryor in his toast at the end of the movie.
Yes.
Random shout-outs. And
Jim Belushi.
And Jim Belushi with Blues Brothers.
Blues Brothers,
clearly.
Yeah.
He actually went to the movies when he was there.
Sorry, John Belushi.
John, yes.
Not Jim Belushi.
Not Jim. Not you. but yeah, it's a no for me, but if anything, gave me other movies to watch, so yay.
Oh, that's cool. That's even better.
And you?
I'm going to probably say no on this one. I wish I could just have...
Two thumbs down.
I wish I could have screenshots of just all of the perfectly framed Roger Deakins shots,
mm-hmm.
especially the ones of the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't know why all movie theaters wouldn't just have pictures of Roger Deakins shots of better movie theaters in them.
We need to open up a movie theater that is an homage, in honor of Roger Deakins.
Yes.
And we just put pictures of his work all over.
His work everywhere. Yeah.
Each theater has a different theme of
we
his 16
get
nominations.
Sued immediately. But I want to do it.
I'm sure he'd be down for it. Well, thank you for listening to Time Sensitive and our review of Empire of Light, directed by Sam Mendes. Remember, you can find our entire Time Sensitive catalog of Under the Radar film reviews just like this one and our Harold and Maude episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're currently listening to us.
And you can interact with Time Sensitive on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Follow us at TSMoviePod. That is at TSMOVIEPOD.
And a quick favor, if you enjoy Time Sensitive, please leave us a quick rating and review on iTunes. It means a lot. It's a nice way to let other people discover our show.
Thank you for joining us for Time Sensitive. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ian.
Take care.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Carol.
And we're the hosts of Retro Late Fee. We are stuck in 1994.
And we can't get out.
We're watching all the movies and TV shows that you probably remember, I guess. Somehow we're speaking to you through some kind of time portal.
Right.
Join us every week for great movies and TV shows from 25 years ago.
It's fun, I swear.